At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the podcast. So I just finished working on a couple of bar fridges. The AC, both systems were down for this bar as well. So now I'm working on these. It looks like I got them resurrected for now anyway. Anyway, guys, listen, Jamie Kitchen from Danfoss. We did a superheat episode a couple of years back, and we're doing subcooling now. It's in high demand, actually, since we did that episode on superheat. It's been in high demand to get the subcooling episode done. So here it is for you guys, Jamie Kitchen from Danfoss on subcooling. This is the HVAC Know-It-All podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master, and they have just brought in the lineup of April Air stuff. So humidification, dehumidification, filtration, indoor air quality products now available at Master Group. Check out master.ca. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas, and they're a major player in the blue collar industry when it comes to uniforms. And something that you need to keep in mind when you're working in this trade is we work in all kinds of conditions, and in the summer we're going to work in rain. It's just a given, right? We don't want to work in thunder and lightning, but sometimes we're going to work in rain and we want to stay dry. So check out cintas.com/HVAC know-it-all and check out their uniform solutions.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All podcast, recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada. Your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC, from storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
All right, Jamie. So listen, ever since we did our, this is going back a couple of years, we did a podcast on basically superheat, and we talked about superheat, how it works with TX valves, how it works with fixed orifices. And ever since then, it's been in high demand to do a subcooling podcast.
Good.
So, I mean, you're in high demand, buddy.
Somebody said that to me yesterday, but it was for a different reason. Yeah.
Subcooling.
Keeps me busy these days.
So, I mean, we have people. So, I had somebody ask me not too long ago to tell me what, or help them define what superheat and subcooling is. Like I was actually up at my campsite, and one of the kids up there, he's 19 years old. He was having a beer. We were cheersing in the picture, and just everybody, he's 19 years old. He's legally allowed to drink. He wasn't,
you have to understand that at our age, a kid is anybody under 25.
Yeah. Right? He wasn't sneaking beers. But he just got a job over the last year, and he's doing refrigeration work. He's in the construction side, and he's like, you know what? I understand the refrigeration cycle to a certain extent. He's like, but I'm having trouble understanding superheat and subcooling. So I sat down, and on this box I drew, this is the way I always start explaining it. I drew a pot of water, and I said, okay, this water is at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. It's boiling. I said, at the top, you got vapor. In the pot, you got liquid. I said, we got liquid and vapor at the same time. I said, if we drop that pot of water to 200 degrees, I said, we've got 12 degrees of subcooling. I said, if we raise the vapor above that pot, if we raise the temperature of that vapor to 220 degrees, we got 8 degrees of superheat. I explained it in a little bit slower pace than that. But at the end, he got it, because we started with water, something that everybody kind of knows. What do you think about that explanation? Do you think that's...
Yeah, thinking about it, we see subcooling all the time. Seriously. I mean, you mentioned water boils or changes state, right? At 100 degrees Celsius or 212 Fahrenheit, you know, at the pressure that we're at right now. But when you open the tap and you let water run out, and let's say you run the hot water and it's coming out at, you know, 140 degrees Fahrenheit, that's subcooled water. It's 72 degrees subcooled, right? 140 plus 72. So, you know, we see subcooling all the time. We don't see superheat. I mean, because superheat really is invisible. I mean, as I mentioned before, I mean, look around you. This is what a superheated vapor looks like. It's the atmosphere, right? It's highly superheated. But when you run a kettle and you see the steam coming off it, that is saturated, right? It's harder to get a grasp of that superheat because you'd literally have to take that saturated vapor that you see coming out of your kettle or your pot, grab it, and heat it again.
Yep.
Like if you could magically run it through another heater after it leaves the pot, you would see that its temperature suddenly rises, it turns clear, transparent. Now you have a superheated vapor.
Yep.
So, you know, when you're running a boiler and you have, you know, superheated steam leaving the boiler and is going out to your rads or coils or whatever, that is an invisible, you know, vapor. It's the same as your refrigerant. You remember back we were doing the trainers, and they had the little clear piping on them at Humber. You could literally see the vapor leaving the evaporator. It was clear, and all you saw was the oil sticking to the sides. Subcooling, a lot of people have a slightly harder grasp of that because I don't think they realize just how simple of a concept it is. Anything, any liquid that is below the temperature that it boils at or changes state is subcooling. However, in a typical refrigeration system, there's only a certain amount of subcooling that you can get. And from an efficiency standpoint, it is more important than superheat. Superheat, you know, has one job in the evaporator, and that is to stop your compressor from going clunk, right? Mm-hmm. And flying either into a million pieces or seizing up or doing whatever. So as you increase your superheat on your evaporator, you're actually lowering your efficiency.
Yeah. So all, so
you know,
so
those
basically,
giant.
So basically, that, I was going to say basically zero superheat would be the most efficient way to run your system.
100%.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it literally lowers the temperature of your coil, average temperature, right? Yeah. By having lower superheat. So you see these industrial systems where they have, you know, zero superheat. They're just drawing saturated vapor off the top of the pot kind of thing. And so they're very efficient and, you know, they get long compressor life. But in a general system like we run in a house or commercial refrigeration application, that superheat is a trade-off that we have. It's a necessary evil in order to protect the compressor. Subcooling, on the other hand, actually increases efficiency. However, it is not easy to get without paying a penalty. Now, let me clarify that. Let's say, for example, your outside air temperature is 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and you're running your condensing temperature at 85. So you have that 15 degree temperature difference. So the refrigerant is condensing at 85 degrees. It's 100 degrees outside. Sorry, other way around. I almost got this backwards. I'm thinking of superheat. Your refrigerant is 100 degrees and it's 85 degrees outside. So because the refrigerant is warmer, you're giving up heat to the outside air. Mm-hmm. Now, when the refrigerant comes out of the compressor, it goes into the condenser a lot hotter than it condenses at. So if it condenses at 100, it might go in, let's say, at 160 degrees. So it de-superheats, if you want to call it that term, from 160 down to 100. And once it hits 100, the pressure that's trying to push it together overcomes the energy of the molecules and they start to stick together. I'm not trying to turn this into a chemistry lesson, but you get my point, is that they're not active enough to stay separated. So the pressure starts pushing them together as they give up heat. And the temperature stays at 100 degrees until there's nothing but liquid left, because we know that's latent heat, right? It's giving up energy and it's condensing from a vapor to a liquid. So this is essentially what happens to moisture in the air when it condenses on the side of a glass, or if you hold the lid over top of your pot when it's boiling, the steam hits it and it condenses. That's essentially what's occurring. This is very important because what you're doing is you are emptying the refrigerant of heat so that it can be filled back up again in the evaporator. So picture the evaporator as a bucket that you're filling up. It's like this cup right here, okay? You know, I've drank all the coffee out of this cup, unfortunately. But that means that it's empty. I can fill it back up again to its whole value. So In the condenser, you are literally emptying that cup out so you can refill it again. The more you empty it, the more room there is to fill it in the evaporator. Because in the evaporator, you're adding heat to the refrigerant. And once it leaves the evaporator, it goes into the compressor, it adds more energy in the form of work. And then all that gets dumped out of the refrigerant into the air in the condenser. Now, you can only get rid of so much heat by going from a vapor to a liquid. And then what's left is what we call subcooling. Because now you have all this liquid refrigerant at 100 degrees. It's 85 degrees outside. So the refrigerant is still warmer than the air. So as it leaves that last part of the condenser, it cools down a bit, just like a hot, you know, coffee sitting, you know, in your room. It's warmer than the air. It gives up heat and cools down. Mm-hmm. So the refrigerant gives up a little bit of heat before it leaves the condenser. And we call that subcooling. Now, most people know subcooling is important because you don't want flash gas in your liquid line. Because if the refrigerant left saturated and it was 100% liquid, but let's say it was 100 degrees, the same temperature it condensed at, as soon as you had any pressure drop on that liquid, it would start to change back to a vapor again because it's that high pressure holding it together. So when you travel down a liquid line, it's not friction-free. There's friction there,
yeah,
right? And so there's always going to be some pressure loss due to friction. Because of that, you would start to boil some of this refrigerant on your way to the metering device because that's next in line, right? You go through your filter dryer. Hopefully it's not plugged, right? And whatever else you have, and you get to your metering device. Now, we know that if you have vapor going into your metering device, it acts like a restriction because it's very hard to pass this low density, high volume vapor through your metering device. It's got this tiny little orifice that it has to go through. It's designed to meter liquid refrigerant. So what happens is you get this pressure wave in your evaporator. Every time you have vapor, the TXV effectively stops feeding the evaporator and the compressor pumps it down. Then suddenly the liquid returns and you get this fluctuating pressure in your system. That's why it's very easy to tell a system that's undercharged with a TXV because the pressures are fluctuating. You don't have enough refrigerant to fill it up.
Yeah. I want to break in with an example.
Sure.
Just so the audience gets like a visual of an actual site. Years and years and years ago, I wasn't involved in this, but I remember, I think I might've brought this up on the last time we did the superheat one or I remember mm-hmm. bringing this up to somebody. There was a system and the receiver was down. So everybody should understand when we have a receiver, we want liquid leaving the receiver to go mm-hmm. to our TX valve and then into the evaporator. So this mm-hmm. receiver was like a few floors below the evaporator. I was never at the site. I was never there, but there was letters written to the customer saying this won't work the way it's been set up. Because I think we came in after the install or something like that to service it. Mm-hmm. And letters were written, this will not work because our receiver is floors below our evaporator. So as that liquid is trying to move up, it's starting to, there's more friction in the pipe and we're starting.
It's head.
Water column
head that you're losing. Yep.
We're starting to flash off in the liquid line mm-hmm. before we get to the TX valve and the system never worked. And I think they had to repipe it at some point or do something. I can't remember what they did.
Yeah, move one section to either closer or move the receiver closer, one or the other.
Yeah, but because we had that restriction and pressure loss moving up from the receiver to the evaporator, the system never worked right. And that mm-hmm. kind of, I just wanted to help maybe with a visual as what you were explaining. So
yeah, anyway. It works both ways. You actually gain subcooling at the bottom of a riser, right? You mm-hmm. know, if you're going down, right?
Yeah.
And
yep.
you lose it going up. And that's an excellent thing because, again, pressure loss lowers your saturation temperature. And if it once it drops below the temperature of the liquid, it starts to boil. It's no different than the example you learn in school when, you know, if you have a jug of refrigerant and it's sitting in a room, it's at saturation. You lower the pressure in it, right? It starts to boil because you're removing that vapor. Right? It has to replace that vapor in order to maintain the pressure. So it's continually bleeding off, right? Same kind of idea. But we, again, know how important subcooling is to make sure you have liquid to your metering device. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, what a lot of people don't realize is that subcooling is a good thing, but as I said before, it's not easy to get. So let me clarify that second part. Remember how I said the refrigerant was 100 degrees and the outside air was 85? Once my dyslexia kicked in and I stopped and I actually realized I had it backwards, but 100 degree refrigerant, 85 degree outside air. Let's say you had a 100% efficient, perfect condenser. The maximum amount of subcooling you can get would be 100 minus 85, right? You 15 degrees. You can't get more than 15 degrees of subcooling, no matter how humongous you made your condenser.
So if you guys are struggling to find the right candidate, find some potential that you can train, find some talent that's already trained up and ready to rock and go on a vehicle for you, do some calls, installs, and you can't find them, check out wisehire.com, because that's what the platform is designed for, to track down candidates, and they have hiring coaches that optimize your ads for you. So check them out if you're in a pickle, guys. So Chirp is a great automated way to stay in touch with your customers, especially through shoulder seasons and stuff like that, or even following up on quotes. It integrates with all the major players in the CRM world, like Jobber, Housecall Pro, and Service Titan, one of the big, huge ones, right? So it's all automated. You stay in touch with your customers through automation, like, hey, it's time to change your filter, or hey, it's time to get your AC serviced. So they have a reminder, and you don't have to remember to do this by yourself. Automated stuff. So check out Chirp, guys. I'm still out here working on these units, and one thing I just did now was clean the condensers on both of these, and clean the inside, and clean the top, because these things were filthy. I use the Porta Blaster by Supco to clean these. This thing is a slick little coil cleaning. I guess it's like, it's not really a power washer, but it kind of is. You don't need a large hose or anything like that and run hoses. You just need a 5-gallon pail of water if you're doing a small condenser or a small unit or something like that. And you plug it in, you stick the hose in the 5-gallon pail, and now you're washing. Now, I coupled it with some Viper maximum strength condenser cleaner. This is a Venom pack. It's a condensed formula. This is a micro channel safe cleaner, and it's non-toxic, and it is an aqueous detergent, meaning that I believe the meaning is kind of when you mix it with water, it starts to act like a detergent like you would use to clean stuff. Anyway, check out the Porta Blaster and check out the condenser cleaner by Viper.
Okay. Now, the bigger the condenser, the closer the refrigerant temperature can be to the air. Mm-hmm. So that's why these big SEER 15, 17 units, you know, aside from throwing in fancy controls and variable speed compressors and fans and everything else, they make their heat exchange surfaces ginormous, right? And you can see that if you compare an old SEER 8 unit from the 80s or 90s to one of these SEER, you know, 15 units, it's half the size. Now, when you're charging a system with a TX valve, you need to charge the subcooling. And if you compare two charts, and I do this when I'm doing my trainings, if you have a low efficiency system and you have a high efficiency system, you will charge to a higher subcooling for the low efficiency system than you will for the high efficiency system. It sounds counterintuitive, but the reason is that the high efficiency system, the refrigerant is much closer to the outside air. Why? Because that means they can lower their condensing temperature, the pressure, right? It doesn't have to be as high, and it saves a ton of energy, but it reduces your subcooling, because instead of having 15 degrees of temperature difference, you may only have 10. I'm just making these numbers up. You get the idea. So with a larger system, more efficient rather, the most you could get would be 10 degrees of subcooling. So if you want more subcooling, you have to increase the temperature difference between the refrigerant and the outside air. This requires more work on your compressor because it requires a higher pressure. Remember, saturation temperature is determined by pressure. So if you want to say, oh man, I want gobs of subcooling in my condenser. Well, yeah, sure. You can get 25 degrees of subcooling out of your condenser if you want, but you're going to have your refrigerant 40 or 45 degrees or 50 degrees warmer than the outside air. And you're going to burn up whatever efficiency gain you get by the extra energy being used by your compressor. So this is why we charge the subcooling with a TXV, because as you add refrigerant to the system, the temperature difference between the refrigerant and the air starts to increase. And once it gets to that sweet spot that the manufacturer has determined, that means you are charged, okay, effectively enough for that system to run. So if we want to increase subcooling to save energy, because remember, we're emptying that cup, we're emptying the pot so we can fill it back up inside of the evaporator. Because once the refrigerant leaves the condenser, the amount of energy in it doesn't change. So when it goes through your metering device into your evaporator, if it had 50 BTUs a pound leaving the condenser, it still has 50 BTUs a pound going into the evaporator, right? So if the refrigerant can hold a maximum of 100 BTUs a pound, right, before it leaves, you know, before it's 100% vapor, then that means all you can add is 50 BTUs a pound. But let's say you take that liquid leaving your condenser and you run it through a secondary cooling loop.
I was going to ask you that.
All right.
Subcooler. Yeah. I was going to ask
you
that. Yeah,
subcoolers. And let's say you take that from 10 degrees of subcooling, which is a fair bit, and you drop the refrigerant an extra 20 degrees. So now it has 30 degrees of subcooling. Here's what happens. That 20 degrees temperature drop has removed more heat from the refrigerant. So instead of 50 BTUs going into the evaporator, it's now 42 or 40. So that when it goes in there, if it's going to leave with 100 BTUs of heat in it, you can literally add 58 or 60 BTUs of heat to the refrigerant in the evaporator instead of just 50, because you've emptied that bucket even more. So what happens is when you go into the evaporator, when the refrigerant expands outside of your TXV, instead of having 40% flash gas, you've only got 30% flash gas. Now remember, flash gas is already a vapor. It does jack all in the evaporator.
Can you explain for the ride? Can you explain flash gas to the ones that are just new and learning, please?
Yeah. Remember how we said when you drop the pressure on the refrigerant and it's at saturation, it starts to boil. So what happens is when the liquid goes through the TXV, because the pressure in the liquid line is higher, the refrigerant can have more energy and still stay a liquid because you've got all this pressure pushing it together. However, when you go through a metering device like a TXV or any simple restriction like a cap, tube, or piston, suddenly that pressure is released. And now the vapor has a lot more energy, or the liquid has a lot more energy than it can hold at that lower pressure. Okay, so if you look at the two tables, a saturation energy for liquid refrigerant at, let's say, 300 PSI and 120 PSI, right? At 300 PSI, let's say that liquid can hold, 40 BTUs a pound, all right? But at the 120 PSI, or 130, instead of 40, it can only hold 25. Well, that extra 15 BTUs of energy has to go somewhere. So it goes into boiling off the refrigerant, the liquid refrigerant, and that's what produces your flash gas. So how much flash gas you produce is determined by the difference in the amount of energy the refrigerant can hold at a high pressure compared to a low pressure. I know this sounds technical, but think about it. You have a refrigerant with too much energy, you release the pressure on it, what happens? That energy goes into making flash gas, okay? So that refrigerant that gets flashed into gas, that's already done its work. It's already been converted to a vapor. It is useless in the evaporator now. Okay, except at the very end where you superheat it a little bit. Okay, so you've already emptied the refrigerant of some capability to absorb heat because you've already made this flash gas. So flash gas is your enemy in the evaporator. Okay, it is completely wasting refrigerant. 100% it's wasting refrigerant pretty much. So it's like nitrogen in the air. Okay, it's just there as a backfill. So if you increase subcooling, you actually reduce the amount of extra heat the refrigerant has compared to what it can hold in the evaporator as a liquid. So instead of having, 40 BTUs of extra heat, or 15 BTUs of extra heat, or 20 BTUs of extra heat, it only has 8 or 7. Okay. So there's much less energy you need to flash into vapor. So instead of having 40% flash gas, let's say you have 25%. Now you have 15% more refrigerant in liquid form in the evaporator. That means you have that refrigerant available to do work in the sense that it can absorb heat. So it's actually like adding extra refrigerant into the evaporator without having to do any extra work on the compressor side. So think about it, right? If you want to cool something down, you put extra water on it, it cools down quicker. So if you have more liquid refrigerant in your evaporator because you haven't flashed it off the vapor, now that refrigerant is available to absorb heat,
more heat.
By boiling into a vapor, mm-hmm. whereas before it was already a vapor. So what this means is that your compressor has to do a lot less work. So instead of pumping 3 pounds a minute, it only has to pump, 2.2 pounds a minute, which means you're getting the same amount of refrigeration effect. You're getting the same amount of cooling, but your compressor is doing a lot less work. Well, we all know what COP is, right? It's, the amount of cooling compared to the amount of energy that you burn. Well, if you're burning a lot less energy to get the same amount of refrigeration capacity or cooling, your COP goes through the roof. Okay. So there has to be some kind of secondary subcooling loop in order to do this. You can't do this in the condenser without burning too much energy. So that's why subcooling is much harder to achieve than superheat, right? In most systems, because superheat wants to occur when you are absorbing energy and we're trying to reduce it. Whereas subcooling, you're trying to increase it as much as possible, but you don't want to burn too much energy in the condenser. So let's take an ideal situation. You have a high temperature or medium temperature rack in a supermarket, and you have a low temperature section. We know the COP is higher on the medium temp, on the cooler, because the evaporator temperatures are lower. So you essentially don't have to do as much work with the compressor to go from the higher evaporator temperature to your condensing temperature, because the condensing temperature is the same for the low temp rack and the high temp rack. So your COP is better on the high temp rack.
Okay.
Let's say you added an extra compressor to the medium temp rack and you took the refrigerant that was coming out of the condenser that's being supplied by, the medium temp rack, and you're running a metering device to your suction line on the low temp rack. So you got this minus 20 section, minus 10, minus 20, the lower the better. And you're literally putting an evaporator, a medium temp evaporator, around the liquid line coming off the condenser. So you got this liquid coming off, right? You're drawing refrigerant off of that, okay, and you're adding subcooling to the liquid going to your low temp rack. So what you're doing is you're using the capacity that's being provided by a medium temp compressor that's operating at a much higher COP than the low temp one, and you're using that to add subcooling to your low temp liquid that's heading to your low temp evaporators. So the extra heat that you remove from the liquid going to your low temp rack allows you to absorb extra heat in your evaporator at low temp. Now remember, this means that your high temp compressor has to do a bit more work, but it's more efficient. Your low temp compressors, which are much less efficient, have to do a lot less work, right? So that means that you might spend an extra 50 cents on electricity for your medium temp rack or your high temp rack, but you're saving 80 or 90 cents worth of electricity in your low temp rack because you're making them do a lot less work. So mechanical subcoolers work excellent if you have a way of cooling the refrigerant in a system that is much less efficient using a system that is more efficient. Okay. And so it's not a, 100% gain. There's still an electrical penalty you're paying, but because that electrical penalty is on the high temp side, right, it is far more efficient than what you're, gaining energy on the low temp side. And that's about as complicated as it gets. But subcooling is great in that it allows you to move less refrigerant and the system is more efficient, but it's only great if there's a way of getting it outside of the normal condensing system.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that it was very technical, and some people are probably going, what did he just say? Okay, guys. Yeah. So go back and listen like three or four times. Just
But the point. Yeah. Yeah. If you have to understand compression ratios and efficiency, and I think most people understand that a freezer is less efficient than a cooler, because if you look at the capacity of the equipment, I don't know how many of you have selected a compressor or condensing unit before, or even a component like a TXV, but for the amount of energy they burn, the amount of cooling or refrigeration they can give drops as the evaporator temperature drops. So what you're doing is you're taking that equipment when it's running more efficiently at high temperature, and you're using it to help you cool stuff on the low temp side that is much less efficient. So it's kind of like splitting a drive between a car that gets, 50 miles to the gallon with a car that gets 20 miles to the gallon, mm-hmm. right? You're not completely eliminating that 20 mile per gallon car, but you're doing a big part of the journey in the 50 mile per gallon car. So the total fuel you burn is less. That's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah. And I mean, sense. Yeah. So I mean, that's why having like, I don't know how many times I've gone to like a little reach in or something like that. And the thing is just the temperature just can't maintain. And then you look at the condenser and it's absolutely blocked.
Okay. Right? Yeah. That's a good point.
You clean the condenser. Right. Cause you're probably getting like almost no subcooling with a block condenser. The thing
we need to kind of cover that because that's an excellent point you make.
Yeah. And then you clean it. And then like 10 minutes later, the thing drops in temp because now we have a clean condenser. We're getting rid of heat. So we're subcooling. The other thing that I wanted to bring up too, is just so people can wrap their head around this whole subcooler thing, is I remember back in the day, Liebert, We used to have this big building in Brampton. Yeah, there was a big, huge server room. And this was at like 2 a.m. I had to go out there. And I think this was like dead summer. Like I was on the roof at 2 a.m, t-shirt, like just perfectly fine. The humidity was high. The temp was high. And one of the condenser fan motors on the Liebert had failed, right? So the thing was going off on high head. And I know what a liquid line should feel like when it's that warm outside, right? And it's okay. Maybe it's 100 degrees. Maybe it's 110 degrees at that point with that type of system, with that type of efficiency it had. So what I had to do was go to the shop, drag a bunch of hoses across the roof, and I set up a sprinkler underneath the, like one of those ones that go back and forth, back and forth. And I set it up underneath the condenser. And man, did it ever, like you're wasting water, but for just so people can wrap their head around this whole, I was getting the condenser colder than what the other fan would have done. So when I'm holding when I'm holding the liquid line, it's much cooler than it would have been even with that other fan running. So we've subcooled that liquid in the liquid line going to the evaporator further because we're adding water and the coil's wet, right?
Yeah, the biggest effect is going to be lowering your condensing temperature because the system doesn't have to lift as high, right? And that's why water-cooled condensers, which are expensive, generally operate more efficiently than air-cooled ones. But coming back, I think, to your little commercial reach-in, I should clarify something when I mentioned subcooling increases with condensing temperature, because that is strictly an effect that occurs with what we would call an adaptive control. And I hate using that word because it sounds super complicated, but think of TXV or electronic expansion valve. In other words, it takes some input signal and it opens and closes to kind of match the load. The TXV doesn't give a crap what your temperature in your evaporator is. It'll operate up or down. It doesn't matter. All it's doing is trying to, react to the amount of superheat you have. Whereas an electronic expansion valve, it can do whatever you want it to do. But if you have a fixed orifice, let's say the old units that had pistons in them, AC units, perfect example for this. You got this outside unit sitting there, and you got your inside evaporator, okay? Your condensing temperature is going to be determined largely by what your outside air temperature is going to be. Yes, the load in the house can affect it, but as we talked about in superheat before, the load in your house is largely determined by the amount of humidity, because the temperature in your house doesn't fluctuate that much. So you've got this piston. It's dumb. It's a hole. It's all it is. All right. Of a given size. So how much flows through that piston is going to be based on the pressure difference across it. No different than your garden hose, right? You have good water pressure in your house, you got lots of water flow through your hose, right? If it sucks at your house, the pressure, you get nothing through your hose. Same idea with this piston. Now, in a refrigerant system, or sorry, air conditioning system that has a piston in it, you got a fixed charge. There's generally no receiver. So what you have in the condenser, what you have in the evaporator, and whatever's sitting in the pipes and the filter dryer, that's it. That's all you got. You need refrigerant in your condenser to give you subcooling. So the situation with a piston for subcooling, and for superheat for that matter, is completely backwards to what it's going to be with a TXV. And we ran into this when SEER 13 first kicked in. And all these pistons were being replaced by TXVs to gain efficiency. The guys that were working on this stuff had never seen or rarely seen TXVs. And it befuddled them because it was completely backwards. So think about it. It's a hot day outside, right? And you got all this pressure in your condenser, right? Compared to the evaporator inside. Where do you think all your refrigerant is going to be? It's going to be in the evaporator. It's going to force all that refrigerant through that piston sitting in your evaporator. So when it's hot outside with a piston, your superheat's going to be low inside, mm-hmm. right? But guess what? So is your subcooling.
Yep.
Because if you've got all your refrigerant in your evaporator, you're starving your condenser, and you're not going to have anything, right, to give you subcooling. So that's a problem, because that can also give you flash gas going into your evaporator, which can reduce the amount of refrigerant you're getting in there. And that comes back to the situation where you had, where you don't really have any cooling, right? You're not rejecting any heat in your condenser, so you can't absorb any heat in your evaporator. It sounds silly, but it's almost like your evaporator is acting like a receiver. It's just backed up with refrigerant, and it's really not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So the opposite is the situation with a TXV. When you have a high temperature outside, right, and your condensing temperature is high, and the compressor is doing extra work, and you're dumping extra heat into the condenser because your compressor is working hard, that's going to increase your subcooling a bit, right? Whereas on a cooler day, you might see slightly less superheat or subcooling. So when you charge to a fixed orifice system, a piston, you have to charge to superheat, because that's how you determine it. And so you'll use your outside temperature, you use your inside temperature or a wet bulb. Whereas with a TXV, you got to charge to subcooling, because the amount of refrigerant you add to a system with a TXV is going to affect the subcooling. The TXV will affect superheat. So you can't use that as a guide, really. Whereas with a piston, as you add refrigerant, right, your superheat is going to drop, because you're injecting more refrigerant into the evaporator as your pressure goes up in your condenser, and there's more refrigerant to go into the evaporator, that's going to affect your superheat. So that's why you charge two different ways, because subcooling and superheat act a lot differently with a TXV than they do with a piston when you're considering the outside temperature.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a long story short, but that's why we charge one with superheat, one with subcooling.
Yeah, no, I get it. And to be honest with you, most of my work has been with TXVs. Mm-hmm. And when I started doing a little bit more residential and stuff, it was the opposite for me. Going to a fixed orifice was like, this is strange. Like, it doesn't seem to work the same. And I had to do a little digging and look into mm-hmm. it myself. And like, why is it working differently than I see with a TXV? But anyway, mm-hmm. that's a different story. But there is a difference between the two, and everybody needs to wrap their head around the concept of both and charge accordingly. I mean, mm-hmm. you got to run in a couple of minutes, but to close this off, if we are troubleshooting a system and we have low subcooling, high subcooling, we need to, and see if you agree with me here, we need to look at both superheat and subcooling in order to determine what could be wrong, like low charge, liquid line restriction, an airflow problem. Mm-hmm. All of these things, if we just look at subcooling, we're not going to know what the problem is until we look at superheat as well, right?
Yeah. Subcooling at the condenser is a good indication of your refrigerant charge.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the condenser's got liquid and you got subcooling, you generally don't have a refrigerant issue for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So before you add refrigerant charge, if you have a low suction temperature, high superheat, with the TXV we're talking about here, check your condenser subcooling and see what it is. Then go to your metering device and see if you still have that subcooling at your metering device. And if not, it's like hopscotching with electricity, right? Find out where the circuit is broken. Where's that voltage drop or difference, right?
Filter dryer.
If you've got a plug dryer or stuck solenoid valve or something like that, that's where you're going to occur. If you have good liquid at your TXV and you've got nothing feeding your evaporator, chances are it's a TXV issue, right? So do the old trick, hold the bulb in your hand, sensing bulb in your hand, try and heat it up. If that doesn't work, you got two options, right? You're going to have to take the TXV out no matter what. You know, if it's got a replaceable orifice in it with a screen, check it to see if it's plugged. Otherwise, if the TXV is plugged, you got to replace it. You know, your job's not done. You still got to figure out where all this crap came from, why the filter dryer didn't catch it or whatever. But, you know, that's part of that. You don't want to be adding charge until you determine that, you know, the charge is needed. So superheat and subcooling are very important things. If you've got high superheat, low evaporator temperature, right, and low subcooling, that's probably a charge issue. But if you've got high subcooling, right, and you've got, you know, low, high superheat and low evaporator temperature, that's a restriction, because basically you've pumped the system down into the condenser, right, is what you've done.
Yeah.
So you have to look at both of them. High superheat combined with high evaporator pressure and temperature means you got a high load on the system. So your TXV is wide open, okay? That could be a size issue. Is your TXV large enough for the system, right? Is it a capacity match, right? These are relatively easy things to determine, but you have to use the process of elimination, exactly what you just said. Take all of these factors involved. They should help you do your diagnostics.
Awesome.
In fact, we should do a diagnostics show down the road.
Hey man, I'm up for any show you wanna get on board with. But
yeah,
I
unfortunately
mean,
today probably got more technical than I wanted to, and I apologize to the audience for that. But hopefully as we go through this, you know, it'll start to sink in. Sorry, Gary.
That's fine. I mean, you get way more technical, like the way you rhyme off numbers and stuff like that. I can't do that. These things aren't in my head. I gotta look at a book or something to figure all this stuff out. That's why I kind of threw in some examples from the field so people could wrap their head around it. And that's why this works. So you're the technical one, and I'm dumbing it down with putting sprinklers underneath the condenser to.
But it works, man. And that's all that matters, is it works.
Yeah. Cool, man. All right. So I know you got to run. I know you have other stuff to do, but I appreciate this, Jamie. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, I appreciate it 100%. And as I say, if anybody has questions, reach out to Gary, myself on LinkedIn or whatever. You know, we're always happy to help explain stuff. It's what we like.
Hey man, I've got 200 messages in my inbox and I'm having trouble getting to them all.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, I try to answer as many people as I possibly can in a daily basis. So, I mean, all right, Jamie, thanks man.
Take care, people. Thanks. Thanks, Gary.
Great stuff, Jamie. And if you guys got confused a little bit, because Jamie gets real technical. Jamie's a smart guy. He can just rhyme off numbers and stuff like that. Go back and listen again, or a third time if you want. I know some people have reached out to me and said they've listened to the superheat episode numerous times to try to absorb every part of it. So thanks, Jamie. Thank you, Dan Foss, for getting involved with the podcast. Now we are a little bit more educated on subcooling, guys, so take that education on your HVAC and refrigeration journey, guys. But I'm out. Happy HVACing.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.